Today, I welcome Professor Emeritus of Kalamazoo College, Leslie Tung, to our studio at WMUK. Dr. Tung has recently completed a recording project, and I've been featuring it over the last few weeks, an album of theme and variations. Welcome, Leslie. Thank you for joining me here today.
Thanks, Kara. It's great to be here.
We have a fair amount of material to cover, I think, because I don't get to talk to you very often on the radio. I'm interested in how you became fascinated with this prototype of the modern piano, the forte piano, and a little bit of your academic life, which you left a few years ago. When did you retire?
I think it's been about... One loses time completely in track of time completely in retirement. So approximately 5 years ago, perhaps, something of that nature. And so I left structured academia, and I live a more free-form academic life now. More up to my spontaneous scheduling day by day. I don't think that I've left academia completely, even in the teaching sense, because I do have students and some private ones every now and then. But the big difference is that when it's time during the day for me to do my own work, my own practicing, my own reading, my own thinking, I find, to be completely honest, that I'm not exhausted.
That you have some reserves left.
Yeah. It's
fewer committees.
It's different. Fewer, no committees actually. Now, it's a great freedom.
Well, congratulations for that. In your 30-plus years at Kalamazoo College, what were some of your overarching missions and duties there?
Well, they were quite varied. Oh. First of all, is to the primary mission, I think, of anyone there is to teach to the uniqueness of each and every student, and they're fabulous students. That's one of the great rewards, I think, of the institution. I mean, we even think now that our closest friends in town were almost all former students at one time. And just really great people who we hope get an expansion of their horizons, their curiosities, discovery of things outside themselves and within themselves as well. So that was always the primary mission. I was a faculty mentor for the second set of Posse Foundation students at Kalamazoo, and they've remained very, very close to me. It's an outstanding program, outstanding organization. One of the great, I think, vehicles, engines, I should say, of social change in the country right now.
The Posse Foundation?
Yeah. It's an organization. Well, let's see. So when President Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, he decided to divvy up the prize money among 10 organizations, and the Posse Foundation was one of them. And the quickest explanation, I think, is that there was a quotation from a student who was admitted to a selective university and found the cultural challenges coming from their particular background to be quite challenging. It's a different, very different environment academically, socially, culturally in general. and decided to leave. And the quotation was, if I had had my posse with me, I might have stayed to graduate. And so the Posse Foundation works out of a series of big cities in the country, Boston, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., among others, and has a selection process for high school students. And the uniqueness of the process means that they can discover students that are not often found by regular admissions processes for colleges and universities. They have a wonderful system which searches not only for academic talent, but for leadership ability in various avenues, social leadership. It can be social leadership, academic leadership, business acumen and talent and so forth. The selection process is quite rigorous. They probably by now the percentage of scholars compared to initial applicants is about the same acceptance rate as Harvard or so, I think around 5%. Each city is affiliated, each posse office city is affiliated with a series of colleges. Kalamazoo College happens to be affiliated with the one in Los Angeles. And each of those colleges will be presented with 10 young scholars selected by the foundation. And the institution provides each of them a full tuition scholarship and a faculty mentor.
So rather than each student braving a new university as a solo individual, this foundation keeps
They can support each other in so many ways. Part of the stipulation is that I in fact meet with them as a group every met with them every week as a group, as well as individually for an hour every other week. So I had a group of 10. 9 were first-generation college students.
Wow.
All 10 graduated. One magna cum laude, two magna cum laude, one summa cum laude. They're all now great personal friends and doing very successful, wonderful things.
Well, for listeners who may have just tuned in, my guest, Leslie Tung, is talking about meaningful work that he did as a professor at Kalamazoo College. And since then, about 5 years ago, he retired and were able to devote some time to solo projects, personal achievements. And one of them is sitting right here on this desk in front of me. It's a new CD recording from MSR Classics of a program of Mozart, Beethoven, and Haydn. And they all share, all the works have this form in common, theme and variations. So why don't we move on a little to the making of this recording? Your affinity for forte piano has long been known to me. There's actually another recording or two in our library of you playing forte piano, early Beethoven sonatas, I think you can find.
Yeah.
So I know you've been passionate about this instrument for a long time, but could you take me back to what sparked it? What began your journey with this?
Yeah, let me see if I... That is a long time. So it's going to take a minute. I think I was an undergraduate. Well, actually, the first thing that sparked it was my reading. As an undergraduate, I wasn't a music major, but I knew that if I wanted to go on to grad school in music, I better bone up on music theory and history. So in music history, I grabbed what was then the classic one-volume History of Western Music by Donald J. Grout. And that edition, way back when, simply had the sentence that the piano was invented in 1701 by Bartolomeo Cristofori. And it had no picture or anything like that. And I later read, I think in some decrepit printed encyclopedia or so, in the days before Wikipedia, that Cristofori built the first piano in his kitchen. And so I walked in, the next time I walked into the practice room with the Steinway, I said, "No, wait a minute. How do you forge a cast iron plate in your kitchen? That doesn't quite make sense." Well, nowadays,
it's
if
not
you look
adding
in,
up there.
Yeah. Nowadays, if you look in the newer editions of Grout, there is a picture of Cristofori's piano. And of course, he was a harpsichord maker and had figured out a rudimentary way, as many people were trying to do at that time, of instead of plucking strings, of hitting strings with a hammer, each hammer connected to a key on a keyboard. And so technically, yes, that is the invention of the piano. I still had no idea of how these instruments sounded, though, until a wonderful friend now came to my undergraduate institution and played a recital on he was just starting out, Malcolm Bilson. And
What a prominent name. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Malcolm played, I don't think it was actually, it was a recital. It was a lecture demonstration. He had a few other students play a replica. My instrument is a replica now. Nobody, you hear very few original, 200-year-old wooden pianos that have survived and been replenished, refurbished adequately. So the sound of the instrument sort of instantly made sense to me. He, I think, played Mozart sonatas or something. I think I was probably the oddball among the, maybe the only one in the entire audience of piano students that really kind of took to it, and I took to it instantly. It just kind of was right to me. I've often wondered about that. Why my inner ear is so weird this way and out of the ordinary.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have been in the practice room on a modern piano for years, you're very tuned to how that is supposed to sound.
And yeah,
it can be a kind of a shock to
I think that's probably it. And in a way, I had some of an in that respect, at least, a bit of an advantage, because although I had played as a kid, I really was never very serious about it. In fact, I never got really serious about becoming a musician until I was in the middle of college, and then a year later I heard this. So I wasn't one of those who had my ear and brain filled hours and hours of every day for years and years. Mm-hmm. With a particular kind of sound. And of course, since then, and nowadays, it's very much easier to make this discovery. What we think of as the piano sound, of course, was not even the piano sound in, let's say, the early 20th century or so, because although the mechanics of and the engineering of the instruments were very much the same, they were for great variety of makers. And so the Steinway sound, which is what you get if you put any CD on, was not the sound of the piano. People came to every concert with very open ears. Mm-hmm. Pianists had to have very open ears and flexible physiologies in order to play all of these different instruments. And then even if you look historically, I've often told people that my belief is that there are about 30 different, distinctly different sounds and instruments, instruments that hammered their strings instead of plucking them throughout history since the time of Cristofori. And they sound different, they play different, and composers use them in different ways. So in one sense, I'm just very much behind the game because, I mean, I have lived my life with two of those 30, you know?
Just two.
Just two, you know?
So I assume that Mr. Bilson would have been traveling with his own instrument.
Right.
Because no schools would have had forte piano available at the time.
Yeah.
And how many years down the road was it before you acquired your own forte piano?
Well, yeah, you're right about Malcolm. He was just starting out and bought a secondhand Chevy station wagon, as they were then called. And it fit in the station wagon. And years later with mine, of course, I had a station wagon as well. It was the way that we could carry our 5-octave instruments around with us. So I got mine about 10 years later. It was the first in a series of projects made by two very talented young people in Northern California, who, as most replica builders nowadays, built from scratch. And my instrument was Janine Johnson and Paul Paletti went to the lumber yard and got the wood that they needed based on a blueprint made by a guy named Thomas Wolfe, who had x-rayed an instrument that sits in the Smithsonian. So from those drawings, they tried to figure out how the thing worked.
So very exact measurements. They didn't just guess.
And still, when you use a lot of these drawings, you discover that the mechanism that actually gets the hammer to the string is superficially, it looks simple. There doesn't seem to be but two moving levers, but the configuration of those levers has to be very, very precise.
Is that where touch comes in? Or?
Yes, it's where touch comes in. Well, first of all, it enables you to get any sound at all. That's one thing. Getting the hammer to the string
with the right amount of force.
That's right, and the right amount of leverage applied at the right place. So that had to be figured out, and then when you look at the music that was written for the instrument that I call the Viennese forte piano. It's actually the instrument that the engineering that dates from about the 1770s. Actually, that same engineering continues through the end of the 19th century. When you look at the music written in Vienna, even, for example, by the three composers on this CD, and you consider the amount of emotion and variety of feeling that is being put into the music, you come to think, wow, these instruments, they sure must have been capable, and the players must have been capable of doing a whole lot, or else the music would have been written in a very different way. It would not have attempted to plumb the depths that we just find in the score. And so the task has been, since this time in the late 70s, early 80s of replica building, to explore further and further in order to get the most singing sound, the most nuanced sound, and still the most distinctively clear sound and articulate sound of the instrument.
Well, before we listen to some of this Mozart, may I tell you what one of probably the main thing I love about fortepiano sound is? It's not the initial production of a pitch. It's what happens afterward.
Yeah.
That sounds so different from a modern piano. I don't know if it's a blending of harmonics or just this bloom or decay of sound. It creates a space and a magic all its own.
Well, all of those things are, that's exactly why I enjoy playing it and love hearing it. I think it's hard to know where to begin. Everything is a different engineering, and it's a different sound objective. And pianos throughout history have had any different sound objectives depending on where and when they were built and so on. These are the sound ideals, I think, that composers had to, in one sense, deal with, and in the other sense, exploit. Because we don't have a cast iron frame that's rolling out of someone's kitchen, you have a wooden frame instrument that sustains less string tension. So they're thinner strings. The hammer heads have to be smaller. They are wooden, covered with leather layer, and so all of those things affect.
Things.
Yes. All of those things affect the sound of the instrument. And as one bit of interesting development that's happening currently, and this makes the field, I think, so exciting. Just in the past couple of years, there's come out yet a third now formulation for the iron alloy that is being used in fortepiano replicas. Makers have a historic interest, and they try to be authentic. So in researching the records of makers of the time and string makers and how the iron was drawn and the mixture was made and the process and that went into the originals, there is now a new, I call it roughly a third generation of fortepiano strings. What I have still the old second generation mm-hmm. on my, but these new strings are producing yet, most listeners would say even more beautiful singing sound on harpsichords and early pianos. So it's a field that's continually developing. I think one of the great lessons that I've learned from it is that it's really to look at instrument, music instrument, or perhaps almost anything, evolutionary biology, what have you, as a linear procession or as linear progress is fallacious. You know, we're better than they were in the previous generation and they didn't know this. That kind of thinking, just because sound ideals changed, were the reasons why older pianos just fell out of use because nobody wants to, they weren't hip and today and cool, you know? So we won't use them anymore. And that happened generation after generation in piano making, when, as a matter of fact, for that generation of time, they were quite ideal, and a lot of artistic work had gone into the making of them and into the playing of them.
That's something I feel like an instinct I was born with, is that, well, today has to be better than yesterday. it just must be because progress, because science.
Yeah.
And just the older I get, the more, yeah, the fallacy of that certainly comes to mind.
If that were completely true, I doubt we would have the Gilmore Car Museum or yeah. Classic car shows or anything like that.
Well, if you tuned in just now, my guest is Dr. Leslie Tung, who has released an album of forte piano works by Mozart, Beethoven, and Haydn. And now we're going to hear the Mozart theme and some of the variations, what we can have time to listen to. I want listeners to picture, though, that Dr. Tung is playing on his own forte piano, a replica of a 1795 instrument that was manufactured in Vienna. And you were in the just cross campus there at the Dalton Center Recital Hall.
I was. Yeah. And it's a spectacular acoustical place to record, and I am not exaggerating it in the least. It's a wonderful, wonderful space. The recording engineer just said it was one of his favorite he's ever encountered.
Well, if you'd like to add this new recording to your collection, it's available through MSR Classics and is available on most of the platforms such as iTunes and Amazon. Let's hear the opening of this theme and variation set by Mozart. The tune is Unser Dummer Purple Mind. Is that an aria?
Purple Mind, yeah. Roughly translates as, yeah, they would think that, you know, or something like that, or yes, that's how the people usually think of things. It's from a popular comic opera by Gluck, and Mozart was at a playing one of his own subscription concerts, and the standard thing was to hear the great soloist do some improv, and so he would very often improvise on the great Broadway tunes of the day in Vienna, and this was one of them. Gluck's sense of humor is very obvious because it starts off with the tune is just in these pretty pedestrian octaves, nothing much going on. They're very foursquare and simplistic in phrase structure. And of course, the simpler the theme is, the more Mozart can do with it.
Let's hear some. Well, that is a recording. We couldn't hear the whole piece because I have the soloist himself right here in the studio, here willing to talk about this program. If we just listen to Les Tung performing Variations, Kirchhoff 455 by Mozart, and the piece hadn't reached its end, but you can always get your own copy of the recording through MSR Classics. It's called Theme and Variations, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn, performed by Leslie Tung. You know what, Leslie? One of the things I love about your playing is there's always a sense of some sort of drama. Like, it's never boring. There's a you really make every line. And what I mean by line is a simple scale pattern, a simple scale or another pattern where you can predict what the fingers are supposed to do. You change it in such a way by pulling back or pushing forward to make it exciting.
Yeah. That's perhaps over generous, but I'll take it. I had teachers that actually encouraged that kind of thing, and even when I didn't have such teaching, I couldn't stop myself.
He wanted
so,
to anyway.
So it's something. But but one minor example, Malcolm Bilson once told me, of all the things to do, for God's sake, do not play evenly.
That's not what most pianists are told.
Have to learn to have a sense of pulse, but even one's walking heartbeat is not metronomically even. Even though our notational system may make it look that way, and even though that's how the notational system may be taught, that's not how living music or life works. So to live in the sound and the feeling and the emotion of the section, the phrase, the individual note, the harmony at the moment, that's beyond notation. Yeah.
Are you also a listening performer, or are you thinking ahead and envisioning the piece as it should, as you hope it comes out in just a few seconds, or are you also reacting to the piece that that music you just played?
That's a great question. I think it was, of course, I was born much too late to ever actually hear Schnabel, but I've read a lot about him, and he's one of my favorite musical personalities. Historically,
Arthur Schnabel is his name.
Arthur Schnabel, right, from the 1930s, one of the first complete Beethoven sonata sets, teacher of so many masters of this day. I think of those surviving, maybe Leon Fleischer is but one example. Claude Franck was one of his later students. Schnabel, I believe it was Schnabel, who said that while you're playing, it's like having three different tape recorders going on in your head simultaneously. One which is, as you said just now, Kara, a little bit ahead, one which is right now, and one which is behind, and having them all interact with each other.
It sounds confusing.
It just
happens.
That's the way one experiences music. I think even as a listener, Nadia Boulanger said, and I'm not even going to try to torture listeners with my French, music is a feat of memory. And she meant listening and playing. We even at a subconscious level are always reacting to what has happened, and we're always anticipating what will happen. We were just talking about in rhythm.
Would you give us a few words on this next theme, which appears on the album? It's Haydn's Andante with Variations in F minor. And this takes a leap in time from the Mozart, I believe.
Yeah. Yes, it does. The two of them were a generation apart chronologically, but of course became great friends once Haydn settled in retirement in Vienna. This set of variations is his last great solo keyboard work. Unlike his younger compatriot Mozart, he wasn't a virtuoso himself. He didn't have subscription concerts in which he would improvise on the fly. But I think it's clear from the way he writes that he knew the instrument and he knew what it was capable of. He certainly had plenty of exposure to good keyboard playing, great keyboard playing in Vienna. And these variations are I want to say unique, but I haven't done all the research to justify that. They're the only ones I've played in which they, of course, there are two themes. It's a double variation. The first theme in minor, and then the second one in major. So the minor one has two halves and they repeat, and the major one has two halves and they repeat. So then you have a major minor, dark and light, night and day, go through. And in the end, you wonder, how is this going to end? Are we in sunshine or are we in? And apparently Haydn struggled with that as well, because in the manuscript, we see that what he decided upon as the final variation was something that he discovered much later after writing. So there you can see the original ideas crossed out. And essentially what happens, there are many people I'm sure who know this piece, is that you think that you're starting out all over again. Instead of a final variation, you return to the original theme. But then the depth of feeling in that minor seems to explode into a level of grief and even an outburst, which sort of breaks the bounds of the theme and variation form, or even the double variation form, and its expectation. We're just talking about expectations. This type of cadenza is the last thing in the world one would expect, and you just can't help thinking that it's Haydn letting loose, letting go of all the feelings that he had at that time. Biographers have said that this is the year that one of his closest friends, perhaps a close or a distant or close love, had passed, and this might have been a reaction.
And I've read that maybe this unusual depth and maybe imbalance of feeling may be pointing the way to music's turn in just a few years with the ushering in of this romantic ideal.
That's clearly true, I think. Yeah.
Well, let's hear this wonderful two-part theme. And remind listeners once again that my guest is Leslie Tung, and his new recording is just out on MSR Classics. It's called Theme and Variations, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn. We just entered the second part of this double variation by Haydn. It's from a new recording of Forte Piano Variations by Mozart, Beethoven, and Haydn by my guest, Leslie Tung. We have less than 60 seconds or so, Leslie. We've given very short shrift to the major work on the CD, which is the Eroica Variation set by Beethoven. You'll have to just find the CD yourself. It's on MSR Classics, iTunes, Amazon, and of course you'll hear it on regular programming on WMUK. Leslie, it's been an enlightening hour. I feel like we just scratched the surface on what the forte piano can do and what it's all about, but hopefully you'll be back again when you have more projects to talk about.
Yes, well, both.
Thank you so much, and news is next. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks again.